Great, another political talk show. Just what America needs. It's time for something different. I figure if you're listening to me, you are obviously a person of very high intellect.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger. With your host, Kathy Wynn.
Wisconsin Public Union employees to Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin. We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. Today's topic on Don't Shoot the Messenger, what union members are doing to organize and protest Scott Walker's attack on working Americans. If you like, you can go to one of our chat rooms at www.jackaloperadio.com and join this discussion there. Our guest today, Nicholas Adams Judge. Nicholas is completing a PhD in political science at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Nick has been involved in politics for many years, both as a volunteer and a professional hired to work on campaigns and legislative initiatives. Nick, welcome to the show, and thanks for being here today on Don't Shoot the Messenger.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I'm glad you're here. And right off the bat, I think I better admit that this issue is a little bit personal for me. I have a brother who is a police officer and a sister who teaches special ed to kids with behavioral and developmental issues. So this gets close to my heart here. I honestly, I couldn't tell you which job is more difficult, though most people would think a police officer's job is harder. My sister goes into a classroom every day full of five-year-olds that are bouncing off the walls and have a lot of developmental issues, and it's a very, very tough job. I don't think people realize that. It also cost her a lot of money to get her degree so that she could do that for her community. So, first of all, I'd like to start out by asking, have you been to the state capitol yourself? Have you been in there and talked to people in Wisconsin?
I have been. I actually live about three blocks away from the capitol, so I have spent an inordinate amount of time there.
And what are you finding there? What are people saying?
Slept there a number of nights, and myself worked as a mover for 2 years, so my back sleeping on marble. But I've spent a lot of time there, and it's quite the scene. It's really exciting.
Yeah. So people are pretty fired up, I guess.
Well, I'm sorry, the reception doesn't seem to be great. What'd you say?
Oh, sorry. So people are pretty fired up, but it looks like from all the news reports that this is a protest that is, for the most part, people are being dignified and respectful, and we're not seeing the kind of things we see with Tea Partiers, with people having guns strapped on and screaming and yelling, and it looks, at least from all the reports I've seen, pretty dignified.
It is. There's a real effort by everyone to be as respectful. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know the Wisconsin Capitol building is a particularly beautiful building. We're, very organized in trying to keep the building clean and respectful of the heritage of the building. So I think that sort of conscious effort of working with the police, with the authorities to... as respectful as we, making sure that our voices are heard, has been something that's really paid off for us and the city as a whole.
Well, I think it has, because I think that is what the rest of the nation is seeing, at least here in Kansas City. What I've seen in friends of mine that have been watching it, we're all impressed with the respectful attitude of the protesters. It's refreshing. Would you say that the people there are, are they optimistic, pessimistic? How long can they hang out there? What are they thinking and feeling the outcome of all this is going to be? Are they worried that it's not going to end up in their favor?
People are cautiously optimistic. We have a very real sense of the tenuousness of our situation that all it takes is one of these Democrats from the state Senate to come back,
yeah,
and the Republicans can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
But the protests have been going on for a long time now. They're not shrinking. They're growing. We continue to receive support from throughout the country. So there's a very real feeling that even if we do lose on this bill, that we've already accomplished something that is going to pay real dividends for workers in the long run.
Right.
And I would count myself maybe slightly in the minority, and I think that there's still a very real chance that even on this bill, we have a distinct ability to win. To,
right.
To keep this, kill the bill, and to move forward on other issues. So there's a scenario where we lose and there's a scenario where we win, and
right,
we can talk about both those scenarios if you want, but we can.
Right. Well, and you actually personally took the initiative and are working very aggressively on behalf of the union employees by organizing a PAC, a political action committee, called Badger PAC. So, first of all, I'm curious about the name. Why did you choose that name?
So, it's actually Badger Protest Pack.
Okay.
And just to plug it, you can go to badgerprotestpack.org.
Absolutely, plug it.
And I've never done anything like this before in terms of start up my own organization. And what I saw was a lot of activists doing a really incredible job with these protests. But what worked for me as someone who studies campaigns, studies American politics, I worried about how long will this last? Can we organize in a way that will last until we start recalling people and having these special elections, or even all the way to 2012 and beyond?
Right.
So that's what Badger Protest Pack is about. And I chose the name because I didn't, even though I myself am a union member, I wanted to show and demonstrate that these protests themselves, the movement itself is developing. We're not just staying stagnant. We're developing as a sophisticated political force to be reckoned with.
Right. So, I'm sorry. Go on.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things about politics is that, you know, the more conflict expands, the more that there's protests on the street, one of the things that we know as political scientists is that legislators are more and more likely to discount that conflict and to sort of try to pretend that it is just protesters that aren't from their district or even out of state, and that it's not reflective of genuine public opinion. So one of the goals with this PAC is to organize in a way that the politicians themselves understand. That if we start doing these things, that creating these large volunteer networks that are active campaigners, if we start raising funds to defeat people that vote for this bill just through small donations, that when we do that, then that's when they understand the message, because they themselves know campaigns, right? I mean, that's all, they just care about getting reelected.
Yeah.
But they can't discount that, you know, can't discount Badger Protest.
Well, there's nothing politicians understand better than money.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty much the bottom line.
Right.
So your ultimate goal is then not necessarily only to focus on this Wisconsin situation, but to take a nationwide kind of stance on protecting unions and American workers nationwide.
Right, and that's actually one of the other, again, why I wanted to start a political organization. You know, Badger Protest PAC. It's not these other unions; it's these protests themselves.
Right.
Because the worry here that a lot of us are having is that if we get defeated here in Wisconsin, that this is the first domino, right?
Right.
And that the same thing is going to, you know, be happening in other state capitals, and that this is really the national Republicans are really kind of going for the jugular here in terms of taking out working class movements.
Right. Right.
So even if we get defeated, what the goal of Badger Protest PAC is to do is to say, along with these other groups that are starting to do some of the same things, is that if the story coming out of Wisconsin is we get defeated and that's the story, then that's really damaging for working people across the country.
Yeah.
But if the story coming out of Wisconsin, even if we lose on this bill, is that we've gotten defeated, but in getting defeated, we've laid the groundwork for wiping out, I don't want to say wiping out, but we've laid the groundwork for defeating Republicans in the coming years, that we've created an organization that is going to really have power in 2012 and before that.
That will kind of stand on its own.
Right. So instead of the narrative and the story coming out of Wisconsin being one of just defeat, it's defeat, but defeat that's a warning to the Republicans and the rest of the country that you can do this if you try hard enough, but you're going to lose in
right.
the long run. And that long run's not too far away.
Right.
So that was why, you know, that's what we were going for.
Right.
But it's been such a success. It's so heartening to see.
And so if it's been a success, how are you doing in terms of money? Is money coming in? How much? Where is it from? Is it coming from all over the country, or is it just coming mainly from Wisconsin people?
It is coming from all over the country, but it is, more than a majority of it is from Wisconsin.
Right.
We've had a few at our founding. We had a small news article in the Huffington Post, and that's something that interested me because we started getting donations the second that article went up, and we got, our PAC is less than a week old, and we got these donations on our very first day. We got hundreds of donations, thousands of dollars, and it was really heartening to see, and it was clear that there was a concern that was very real throughout the country, but also that it was particularly acute in Wisconsin, since most of the donations were from Wisconsin, even though, hundreds were also from the rest of the country.
So right.
It's to have an organization that is 1 week old, that has this kind of fundraising base and this sort of set of dedicated volunteers that's literally been growing every single day. Someone else is, willing to put in some serious time. It's just so exciting.
And so maybe explain a little bit about political action committees, because I'm not sure that everybody understands. You don't actually funnel money directly to candidates. I think by law you cannot do that, right?
We don't. I mean, we're not going to. Political action committees are able to donate to candidates if they want, mm-hmm. but that's not what we're going to be doing. Political action committees are basically a legal entity that allows you to do everything that a campaign does. So you can raise money, you can spend it during campaign season. In our case, we are just a state political action committee. So even though we hope to have an effect that's national through the message that we send, we are only dedicated towards state races in Wisconsin.
Right. So you can, I could be wrong, so correct me if I am, but my understanding of political action committees is that you can basically run your own campaign for someone or against someone, which kind of gets around the problem of campaign finance laws. So instead of just giving money to someone, you actually can run ads for someone on their behalf. Is that right?
I'm sorry. You blanked out for the last.
Okay, sorry. I guess I'm asking about the kind of the details on the way that political action committees run parallel campaigns. At least that's been my understanding of it, that they don't necessarily give money to candidates, but they can run their own campaign for someone. In other words, they can run ads, they can make bumper stickers and sell them, they can make signs, and essentially run a parallel campaign, which kind of gets around campaign finance laws. Right.
Yeah. Well, we do have the organizations that get around campaign finance laws are what's called 527s or 501c's, and those are just kind of where they are in the tax bracket. So one of the reasons we chose to be a PAC as opposed to one of those organizations is that we believe in transparency. We believe in donor limits. We are restricted by some campaign finance laws, and that's okay because we are being funneled fully by small contributions. We've had we've had a number of contributions that are $500, but we haven't had ones that are larger than that, and that's because our message is, you know, we're not. It would be nice to have donors, and certainly if anyone would like to be a big donor, that'd be great. But we are. You know, we want to be a grassroots organization. We're not asking people for a lot of money. You know?
Right.
So so what we're capable of doing is, yeah, all of those campaign activities. And we, as election season gets closer, we're not going to have the ability to coordinate with other groups such as parties or other political action committees. But we're going to be able to be looking at the same strategic variables, deciding which races to target, which state senators to target. So it allows us to do quite a lot, but we still get to, you know, abide by the transparency and donor limits that we think are ultimately a good thing. So.
Right. And there are a lot of people who believe this is, right now in Wisconsin, the issue is public workers, but that possibly big corporate interests like the Koch brothers are actually interested in breaking all unions if they can get away with it. I mean,
I think so. I mean, I think there's a 100-year history plus of people like the Koch brothers doing their best to break unions, break other working class movements. And, you know, one of the reasons that they don't seem to be now, or they're trying to win, but they've had way more of a reaction than they could have anticipated. You know, you hear in the protests a lot that they've sort of woken a sleeping giant. Is, you know, the game is changing a little bit. Now people can go online, they can give $5, $10, and when a couple million people do that, well, now millionaires aren't so special in politics. And even though we're far from that, eradicating the influence of overly wealthy political activists, it's still an exciting, you know, it's 10 years ago we wouldn't have had the ability to fight back like we do now. And now with the internet, with social media, we really have an ability to organize quickly, to raise funds quickly, to just receive small donations from people that, you know, they don't have to sit down and write a check and go through all these hoops to donate, but they can just go online, give whatever they want to give. And that gives us an ability to respond to the sort of corporate influence, the overly moneyed influence that just didn't exist 10 years ago. So it's another thing that's really, really exciting.
Right. So I send you $20, and I know you have long-term goals about taking this nationwide and you know, having a much bigger impact than just Wisconsin. But what would you do with my $20? What are you using that money for? And how do people know when they send you money how it's being used? What's the accountability?
Well, the accountability is that all of our spending and all of our fundraising will be published, I believe, each political quarter. So in the sense that you can see directly what's going on, that's your accountability. And obviously, any sort of complaints to the contrary would be so damaging that there would be no logical reason to do anything other than campaign with these $20. But what we're going to do is we're going to focus on two groups. One, Republicans that are vulnerable in the state senate especially. But more than that, there are a handful of state senators that people think might be wavering. I don't want to single them out now because you don't want to communicate that about those Republicans publicly because you want to give them room to actually waver and to vote against the bill.
Right.
But what we're going to do in private and then back it up with campaign actions is we're going to say, if you vote against this bill, you have a pass from us for now. You know, we're not political allies with any of those people. We wouldn't want to not campaign against them, but we're saying we need a handful. And if you vote against the bill, you're not going to really hear much from us. If you vote for this bill, we are coming at you with everything that we have, hundreds of volunteers by the time that election time gets around, tens of thousands of dollars of election spending, and there's going to be a lot of other groups making the same decision. So it's starting to, again, it's starting to speak the language that these guys understand, that we're not just protesting out in the street. We know what we're doing. We know how to run a successful campaign, and it's going to be coming at them if they just want to ignore the desires and hopes of working families across our state. So,
right. Right. So, you know, you mentioned that a decade ago it wouldn't have been possible to launch this kind of initiative with the same level of ability to communicate with people quickly through the internet and social media sites. Where do you... some people think that it goes back to Ronald Reagan when he broke the air traffic controllers union, but how far back do you think it goes? What do you think it was that sparked sort of the weakening of unions in this country? And if they've been kind of on a downward trend for the last 30 years. What do you see the origin of that kind of weakening of the strength of unions? Where did that start?
Well, the history of it is that very little to do with anything except the power of working class movements. The history of it is that there was always a dominant wing within the Republican Party that did not accept the basic tenets of the New Deal, the basic tenets of a modern set of labor laws that include rights to organize that are guaranteed throughout the Western world and beyond. So there has always been this push. I think that under Reagan, under some of the changes to the political economy of the United States, and frankly, some of those changes were brought about by Democrats. Carter administration had a good short-term record on labor, but they had the long-term influence on union organizing that came about from quickly deindustrializing as a country, started to give workers or started to give business the upper hand. So it's been a long, I guess you're asking a political scientist to talk about a century of politics. So I don't know.
It could take a while.
So Reagan certainly was a reassertion of that wing of the Republican Party that was willing to engage in open warfare with the unions.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing, when Taft was son or grandson of the president, Taft was seeking the Republican nomination before Eisenhower got it in the 50s, there was fear that he was so hated by unions because of this Taft-Hartley Act that he had passed that the Republicans were scared to nominate him because unions effectively had a veto over the Republican nomination.
Wow.
So that's sort of how politics operated when you had a third of the country belong to unions. And as our numbers have been slowly rolled back over the decades, there gets to be these points where with Reagan or with Scott Walker now, there's a politician who's willing to push the envelope a little further and be even more brazen, even more callous and heartless in his attacks on the working class. And I think they were hoping that this would be sort of the final defeat. The only unions that are truly strong in this country, if we're comparing this country to other countries, are the public sector unions. It's similar to what Republicans do about once a decade when they attack Social Security, right? Mm-hmm. There's the old saying that Social Security is the third rail of American politics because touch it and your political career dies. And a Republican operative once had the great quote of, Social Security is only the third rail of American politics if you touch it, you know? It looks like you can win, and then when you go to try to really take out Social Security or take out the last vestiges of, you know, a truly powerful working class movement, well, you know, you touch that third rail and you're going to get burned. So,
yeah,
this is an attempt for them to push the envelope, we think that they have made a big mistake. And
yeah,
that seems to be a developing consensus, so that's encouraging.
Right. You mentioned that you're a member of a union. Which union do you belong to?
I belong to the Teaching Assistance Association.
Okay.
So that, you know, as a graduate student, I teach. I've got 72 undergraduate students that I'm doing the grading for them. I'm leading the discussion sections. That's the office hours they go to often. So that union has done a really remarkable job really kind of leading, even though we're one of the smaller unions that are involved in these protests, we have a lot of people that are really dedicated, you know, and you have a certain advantage as a union of graduate students. You know, I study American campaigns, so it's, you know, you have a knowledge base that can help you be effective.
Right.
So that's also been another sort of fun thing about these protests, is to see union members from different backgrounds, totally different jobs, all come together, and we're coordinating in a way that has really been powerful. So,
right. And how do you respond to people that think that the way our economy is right now, everybody's suffering, people are all having to, in their own personal lives, make a lot of sacrifices and give up a lot of luxuries. So why mm-hmm. should unions be able to push for more vacation days and higher pay and all of these kinds of benefits that taxpayers fund when all of us are feeling a pretty significant pinch in our own financial situations? How do you respond to that?
Oh, boy, I've got a lot of responses. The first one I hear is myself is I make before taxes $1,100 a month. So if anyone wants to characterize me spoiled union member, you try living on that amount for 5 or 6 years, right? You know?
Yeah.
The second one is that this is a question of rights. That historically speaking, you can talk about all these different rights that you want, but the bottom line is the right to collectively bargain is the one that protects a lot of other rights. The third argument is that the economics of a sort of anti-union argument is just wrong. Working class people, poor people, the further down the income scale you go, the more it makes economic sense for those people to have enough money to spend. Because they go out and they spend that money. They're not investing it in foreign exchange markets. They're not speculating on currencies or anything else where you just take trillions of dollars, take it out of the economy, and it doesn't do anything good, right? There was no union derivative from the housing market that sank the economy, right? Those were wealthy speculators with those type of things.
Right.
When working class people have more money to spend, they don't have money to waste, so they tend to spend it on things they need, and that tends to help the economy a lot.
So it goes directly into the American economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that a teacher that's earning $20,000 a year or something like that is going to be taking that money out of the economy. And the quicker people spend it and the more they spend it on real goods that other people in the economy make, the quicker our economy. So it's wrong historically. An anti-union argument is wrong in terms of these. One of the funny things about this whole campaign is that they've been trying to demonize public sector employees and say, well, they're spoiled, you know, and it's like, well, you know, does a fireman who's rushing into a fire, is he spoiled? You know, is a teacher, yeah. Like I believe you said your sister was mm-hmm. a special ed teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the notion of demonizing these people who, when you look at all of our jobs, we are the people, you know?
Yeah.
We are, and if you're not yourself a member of a public sector union, well, you know, and you're going to a university, well, all those people are public, you know, you're getting your education from those people. You're going to a high school, you're getting those education from public sector employee unions. If you get a heart attack and an EMT comes and picks you up, you're probably getting picked up by a public sector employee union. So there is this argument that public sector employees are paid more than the average worker. And that argument is, while technically true, has nothing to do with the reality of the situation. Because a lot of these jobs that public sector employees have, like teachers, EMTs, professors, other people like that, they are highly skilled jobs that require a lot of training because they're so important and everybody cares about them. So,
You're willing to pay the EMT who rushes to your house while you're having a heart attack just about anything, I would guess.
Yeah. Let's watch one of these, you know, Republican politicians criticize public sector employees if they happen to, you know, break their knee or have a stroke or something. And they're spoiled workers then. So.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure if they call the police department in the middle of the night because someone's breaking into their house, they would be very happy to pay that police officer, you know, a good salary. Yep. And you mentioned that, you know, you make about $1,100 a month and you're working on a PhD. And that's something I wanted to talk a little bit about because, again, my sister, the special ed teacher, just recently completed her master's degree, and she had to borrow a lot of money to do it. Nobody paid for that. The government did not pay for her education. She borrowed money and is paying it back with interest to advance her education, which was required for her to continue teaching.
Right.
And so she's not only not making a great deal of money, but she's spent a great deal of money to be able to have the privilege of working with very, very difficult children every day.
Right.
Yeah.
That's another part of it. The notion of that these people are paid more has not, they're not, you're not counting how much they sacrifice either through student loans and things like that or through foregoing earning other, you know, a TA earns just enough to get by on.
Right.
And we forego, you know, a lot of us, these are hard programs to get into, right? A lot of the people that are organizing this protest in the Teaching Assistance Union are going to literally the top sociology program in the entire world. And for them to, these people could ride their ticket on Wall Street if they wanted to, right? They could be making millions, but they choose to earn $10,000 or $11,000 a year. And, you know, so that's another type of sacrifice. And we're all, you know, heavily indebted to student loans. To just sort of not count that money as though it's kind of pretend or something I don't want to associate a TA having not a lot of money with truly being poor, because I have in my life been truly poor. And I'll tell you, it feels very different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that being said, these are incredibly hardworking people, and they're foregoing, or, you know, they're taking loans or foregoing opportunities that are, you know, in any society that at all cares about its education, people should, you know, value that, that sacrifice. So.
Well, and I think, too, that another role that public unions play in society is their regulations many times are set up to protect the worker, but they have sort of a side effect of protecting us. I just recently read about a union regulation for union nurses in Wisconsin that they can never be assigned more than 4 patients at one time. I personally, when I go to the hospital, don't want a nurse who has 15 other patients to deal with. So, and that's not a law. It's not a statute. It's actually a union regulation that nurses cannot be given more patients than that to take care of.
Yeah, that's another thing about unions that these people trying to demonize unions conveniently forget, is that a lot of these regulations, they're not protecting, you know, if a union is able to limit So in my own instance, I have 72 students, and that's over four different discussion sections. So in part because of the union pushing to have a reasonable working semester, class size is reduced to 18 people per discussion section.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's the size where you can have a real discussion. And kids can really learn and grow as human beings. And
right.
And if, you know, if the union's not there for that, well, maybe, you know, discussion sessions start being 30 people, or maybe classrooms start being, you know, 40 or 50 people. And,
sure.
And it's, yeah, unions often take the role of sort of regulators of last resort when the government is not ensuring a nurse who is not so exhausted she might make a mistake.
Right.
Or a teacher, you know, doesn't have to handle a classroom of 50 kids or something impossible.
Right.
Like
or
that.
A truck driver has to stop and sleep after driving so many hours on the highway. Who wants to be on the highway with truckers that can drive for 18 straight hours?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. So there are public safety issues at play here, too. I have another question, and this is not related necessarily to public employees. In fact, not at all, because I don't think really there's any kind of corruption that people would associate them with. But there is with a lot of private unions, like the Teamsters. There's a history there of corruption and association with organized crime that I think sometimes taints unions in people's minds. It's very easy to think in terms of Jimmy Hoffa, when you think about unions in this country. So how do you combat that kind of bias?
Well, it's a good question. One of the history of it is that, you know, in the 1920s and the 1930s, in the decades before that, there was some relationship between unions and, you know, not all unions, but some unions and organized crime. And one of the major ways that that came about was that that management and business had been organizing very violent resistance to peaceful union organizers, and that strikes would fail when these thugs were brought in by management to break the strikes, and that at some point in some urban environments, there started to be a relationship between the only other people. If the government wasn't going to protect these innocent workers from getting beaten to death, then there were, unfortunately, organized figures in organized crime that were at times, you know, willing to help out, often just because of social connections. You know, they grew up in the same neighborhood or something.
Right.
And, you know, another sort of part of that story is that was all happening at the time that Prohibition was giving such a huge slice of the economy to organized crime, you know, these bootlegs, stuff like that. So there was this legacy that lasted for 20 or 30 years of that sort of corruption. And it was unfortunate, but it sure as hell was happening in sectors other than unions as well.
Sure.
And, you know, but that is just so
really
far.
Do you think there's any corruption in corporations? I'm being sarcastic.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, yeah, I was going to. You got me. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, nowadays, if you look at, that's a good point. I mean, if you look at where corruption comes from, right? Where the most corruption cases are, they often involve dirty politicians and they involve business. The sporadic example of some sort of union corruption is few and far between. I don't think anyone thinks of unions anymore as these great bastions of power.
Right.
And so it's not like corrupt people flock to working class movements that are under siege, you know.
Right.
You know, when people, I guess what I say is to that argument about union corruption is that when your political arguments are relying on Hollywood movies from 50 years ago, you know that you've got a weak political argument.
Right. Well, let's talk for a minute about the Koch brothers, because they are allegedly very much financially behind Scott Walker and this whole kind of power trip that he's on, an attempt to break unions. Well, just speak to that. I know that they are a huge conglomerate. In fact, I went on the internet today and I was trying to find a list of companies that they're involved in and products, and it's so long, and it's their tentacles really reach into just so many areas of consumer goods and the petroleum industry that I'm not sure how you really could organize an effective boycott against these people.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it would be possible in the long run. I think that, you know, if they had some brand name that people understood was boycotted, then they would just change the brand name and put out the same product elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, I'm, as a political scientist, or, you know, as a graduate student studying political science, I am always wary to attribute to specific personalities the source of all of this ruckus.
Mm.
You know, I think that if the Koch brothers weren't there, there would be someone else like them doing the same thing.
Right.
And, you know, it's sad, and we need to bring attention to individuals that are so clearly corrupt. But at the same time, we don't want to create a political narrative that if we defeat these two people, you know, these brothers, then we've won or something like that, because someone else is going to step into their shoes. And that type of, you know, focusing just on the individuals, which to some extent you have to, but at the same time, we need to, you know, make sure that people know that this is something that isn't an individual thing. It's something that is wrong with American, with the American economy.
Yeah, you know, it's systemic. It's systemic. It's a pernicious problem. It's not the Koch brothers themselves. They're just kind of playing out playing with the system that exists. So like you say, somebody else would just step into their place. And one of the things that I discovered when I was looking at all of these... I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So I was looking at many of these websites that are encouraging boycotts of their products. And like I say, I think it would be very hard to really figure out how and what to boycott. But one of the things that surprised me is that on one of these lists, I saw something I never even realized was possible, which is that you can actually own a type of fabric. The Koch brothers own Lycra. Did you know that?
I didn't.
They own Lycra. And I thought, well, you are never going to get women to give up Spanx. They're not going to give it up even for America. The swimsuit industry alone, I mean... But that was kind of amazing to me, and that it seemed like the more that I looked at those kinds of lists, the more unrealistic it became, really, to think that we could launch any kind of a boycott that would have a truly any kind of impact.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's one of the things. It's one of the reasons why I founded Badger Protest Pack, was because there are a lot of things we can do as concerned workers, as concerned American citizens, that are, you know, might be effective. Maybe there'd be some particular boycott that would, you know, hurt their bottom line, but they're not going to back off. You know, those guys are ideologues. And so there's always various political strategies we can do that are, that, you know, are activism, and we don't want to discourage people from doing those things. But that, you know, if we can focus our political energies in the most effective strategy,
right?
You know, if we can, whether it's my political action committee or others, if we can concentrate our efforts in the way that we know is the most effective way to get things done, then that's a lot different. You're right. Than these kind of diffuse strategies of, you know, a boycott here, a protest there. So I, you know, it is self-serving for me to say, but I would encourage people that are engaged in boycotts, you know, I'd say keep going with that. But I would say that as someone that has tried to study politics from a social scientific perspective, if we want to be effective, you know, small donations or volunteering in a campaign environment is the way that, you know, I wish there was no money in politics. I wish that
I agree.
We didn't have to, you know, spend weeks on end volunteering to make something happen. But the reality is that that's how you can win or lose political battles right now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So, you know, you never want to discourage someone from doing something good, but you do want to encourage them to be as productive and to really have, you know, the Koch brothers know what they are doing, and they are engaged in these type of campaign activities.
Mm-hmm.
And through this movement, you know, whether it's Badger Protest Pack or Progressive Campaign Committee was out with an ad, and, you know, there's another kind of group of really dedicated people who know what they are doing, you know, who
right.
have real expertise in these things.
Right.
And, you know, when we can harness that expertise and be as effective as someone like the Koch brothers, then I don't think in the long run they stand a chance.
Right. Well, Nick, we don't have a lot of time left, but in the time we do have, why don't you tell me, as somebody in Kansas City, but could be anywhere in the United States outside of Wisconsin, why we should care about this and why we should donate money to BadgerPackProtest.org. I'm sorry.
BadgerProtestPack.org. Yeah.
Okay.
I forget it. I start saying .com and it messes me up. Well, I think that we should care about this because this is going on everywhere. And this is just the first skirmish of a larger battle that we're going to see over the next 2 years in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Indiana, in California, in pretty much every state, you know, in Missouri, in Kansas, in any state where working class organizations have a real, you know, chance and a real say in politics, that this is the time that national figures have decided that they're gonna go for the throat and they're gonna kind of try to get the final win.
Right.
And so, the first battle matters a lot, right? You know, I mean, if the American Revolutionaries had lost in Lexington. Or conquered, you know, the whole revolution could have looked very different. And so that's why people need to care about this. And what I'm saying with Badger Protest Pack is that by doing two things, one, by donating to a group that is specific to these protests, we send the message that we're becoming a powerful movement that is going to last to campaigns, and we send a message that's going to scare the politicians that are trying to attack us.
Right.
So that's why I think donations, you know, in lieu of being able to volunteer if you're not close to these protests, donations are probably the single most effective thing you can do.
Right.
With Badger Protest Pack, what I would say is that we're a very effective organization. We're just a week old. We are not tied in with larger groups that might have, you know, their own agendas. And we're the rare combination of that type of grassroots organization that also has a real expertise, you know.
Right.
Why I'm getting a PhD in political science is in order to develop as much of an expertise as you can possibly develop and being as effective as possible.
Right.
In that sense, I think donations are the most effective way to go if you're not close by. And for donations to our organization specifically, I think that we have people on the ground, myself, a couple other people, who have, this is a purely grassroots campaign, purely grassroots organization, but we're going to be as effective as any professional organization that is working on these issues,
right?
If not more so.
Nick, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate
it was a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate your insight on all of this. Good luck with everything. I think it's admirable that you've taken this on along with finishing a PhD, because Lord knows I couldn't do probably either one of those things. But I admire your initiative. And listeners, if you're interested in making a donation, if you care about the future of working class Americans, as Nick has pointed out, this might appear to be an isolated situation of public workers in Wisconsin, but truly it will affect all of us in the middle class. If you're a billionaire, you're probably not listening to this show anyway, but you don't need the website. But for the rest of you that aren't billionaires and do think this is an important issue, it's www.badgerprotestpac.org. And you can go to that website and make a donation. They'll be happy to take $5, $2, $10, whatever you have. Obama won the presidential election off of a lot of $10 and $20 donations. So, again, Nick, good luck to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye-bye.
So, listeners, as Nick pointed out, middle-class Americans, we don't have the money that corporations like the Koch brothers have. We don't have the money that a lot of Republican backers have. So we cannot buy politicians like Scott Walker to do our bidding. But we do have one major resource on our side, and that is that there are more of us than them, and our principles are not for sale. That there really, truly is one big fat reason that Republicans took control of the House in the last election. And it doesn't have anything to do with a tax revolt. It has nothing to do with Obama's health care reform bill. It's got nothing to do with abortion or gay marriage or environmental protection or any other social or economic issue. This is what it boiled down to. Liberals and progressives stayed home. We sat it out. We didn't step up. We gave our rights and our freedoms to people who will not be satisfied until we're all working for them at below minimum wage without health insurance or overtime pay or vacations or the right to a safe working environment. And you really can't blame Republicans because they showed up to vote. They showed up to donate to their candidates and causes, and they showed up in big numbers. They do have a lot more money than we do, but again, there are more of us than them. So it's time for us to step up. The very first show that I did at the beginning of this year, I used a quote by Oprah Winfrey, and she said, "Cheers, America, to a new year, a new chance to get it right." So let's get it right. Get up. Call your elected representatives and tell them what you want and don't want. Demand your rights. Write letters to the editor of your local paper. Support union jobs by buying American products when you can. Send money if you're able. You could start out by giving to BadgerPackProtest.org and show support for those people who are sitting in the state capitol putting their lives on hold every single day. You know that many of these people have families, that they have to figure out what to do with their kids. They're making sacrifices, and it's not just for their own economic interest. They're doing it for the principle. So we need to support them. If all you've got is $5, then send $5. If enough of us do it, we can win this. We can fight back. And we can make sure that the middle class in this country does not die and we do not become a nation of rich and poor. So I'm going to end the show this week with a quote, as I always do, if I can find it. And it is by Franklin Roosevelt. And it goes like this. What Franklin Roosevelt said on May 8th, 1937 is this: "The right to bargain collectively is at the bottom of social justice for the worker as well as the sensible conduct of business affairs. The denial or observance of this right means the difference between despotism and democracy." That's it for this week. I'll see you next Thursday on Don't Shoot the Messenger.
Hey, before you go, I have to tell you, you're doing an amazing job, Kathy.
Thank you,
Todd.
I just
want you to know that. I think you're doing great. And today you did great. We had, whenever you do any kind of interviews on a cell phone, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of cell phones.
I know.
And he was having some cell phone issues, and you guys did good. You really pulled
good.
It off.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Todd.
Everyone loves the show.
Todd is the real genius behind everything that goes on here. He's amazing. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
There's a bright golden haze in the meadow. I peep out, there's a bright golden haze in the meadow. The cone is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Well, I say, oh, what a beautiful morning. Yeah. Yes, what a wonderful day. Y'all look out there. I've got a beautiful feeling. Everything going my way. Y'all come on now. Oh, the cattle are standing like statues. The cattle are standing like statues. They don't turn their heads as they see me ride by. But a little brown maverick is winking her eye. She said, oh, what a beautiful morning. Yeah. Well, what a wonderful day. I want y'all to know, no, I've got a beautiful feeling. I've got everything. And everything going my way. Everything going my way.
Don't Shoot the Messenger with your host, Kathy Wynn, a Jackalope Radio production.
All the sounds of the earth are like music. The sounds of the earth are like music. The breeze is as busy, it don't miss a tree. And a little old weeping willow is laughing at me. She said, oh, what a beautiful morning. Yes, what a wonderful day. Y'all, I got a beautiful feeling. I got everything. I got everything. I got everything. Woo! Everything's going my way.
I'm sorry.
But I got everything going my way, my way. Oh, baby. Oh, baby. I want to thank you, little girl, for such a wonderful day. My way.